Chapter 2. Among the many fatalities attending the bloom of young desire, that of blindly taking to the confectionery line has not, perhaps, been sufficiently considered. How is the son of a British yeoman, who has been fed principally on salt pork and yeast dumplings, to know that there is satiety for the human stomach even in a paradise of glass jars full of sugared almonds and pink lozenges, and that the tedium of life can reach a pitch where plum buns at discretion cease to offer the slightest excitement? Or how, at the tender age, when a confectioner seems to him a very prince whom all the world must envy, who breakfasts on macaroons, dines on meringues, sups on 12th cake, and fills up the intermediate hours with sugar candy or peppermint, how is he to foresee the day of sad wisdom, when he will discern that the confectioner's calling is not socially influential, or favorable to a soaring ambition? I have known a man who turned out to have a metaphysical genius, incautiously, in the period of youthful buoyancy, commence his career as a dancing master, and you may imagine the use that was made of this initial mistake by opponents who felt themselves bound to warn the public against his doctrine of the inconceivable. He could not give up his dancing lessons, because he made his bread by them, and metaphysics would not have found him in so much as salt to his bread. It was really the same with Mr. David Faux and the confectionery business. His uncle, the butler at the great house close by Brickford, had made a pet of him in his early boyhood, and it was on a visit to this uncle that the confectioner's shops in that brilliant town had, on a single day, fired his tender imagination. He carried home the pleasing illusion that a confectioner must be at once the happiest and the foremost of men, since the things he made were not only the most beautiful to behold, but the very best eating, and such as the Lord Mayor must always order largely for his private recreation, so that when his father declared he must be put to a trade, David chose his line without a moment's hesitation, and, with a rashness inspired by a sweet tooth, wedded himself irrevocably to confectionery. Soon, however, the tooth lost its relish, and fell into blank indifference. And all the while, his mind expanded, his ambition took new shapes, which could hardly be satisfied within the sphere his youthful ardor had chosen. But what was he to do? He was a young man of much mental activity, and, above all, gifted with a spirit of contrivance. But then, his faculties would not tell with great effect in any other medium than that of candied sugars, conserves, and pastry. Say what you will about the identity of the reasoning process in all branches of thought, or about the advantage of coming to subjects with a fresh mind, the adjustment of butter to flour, and of heat to pastry, is not the best preparation for the office of Prime Minister. Besides, in the present imperfectly organized state of society, there are social barriers. David could invent delightful things in the way of drop cakes, and he had the widest views of the sugar department, but in other directions he certainly felt hampered by the want of knowledge and practical skill, and the world is so inconveniently constituted that the vague consciousness of being a fine fellow is no guarantee of success in any line of business. This difficulty pressed with some severity on Mr. David Faux, even before his apprenticeship was ended. His soul swelled with an impatient sense that he ought to become something very remarkable, that it was quite out of the question for him to put up with a narrow lot as other men did. He scorned the idea that he could accept an average. He was sure there was nothing average about him. Even such a person as Mrs. Tibbetts, the washerwoman, perceived it, and probably had a preference for his linen. At that particular period he was weighing out gingerbread nuts, but such an anomaly could not continue. No position could be suited to Mr. David Faux that was not in the highest degree easy to the flesh and flattering to the spirit. If he had fallen on the present times, and enjoyed the advantages of a mechanics institute, He would certainly have taken to literature and have written reviews, but his education had not been liberal. He had read some novels from the adjoining circulating library, and had even bought The Story of Inkle and Jericho, which had made him feel very sorry for poor Mr. Inkle, so that his ideas might not have been below a certain mark of the literary calling, but his spelling and diction were too unconventional. When a man is not adequately appreciated, or comfortably placed in his own country, his thoughts naturally turn towards foreign climes, and David's imagination circled round and round the utmost limits of his geographical knowledge, in search of a country where a young gentleman of pasty visage, lipless mouth, and stumpy hair would be likely to be received with the hospitable enthusiasm which he had a right to expect. Having a general idea of America as a country where the population was chiefly black, it appeared to him the most propitious destination for an emigrant who, to begin with, had the broad and easily recognizable merit of whiteness. And this idea gradually took such strong possession of him that Satan seized the opportunity of suggesting to him that he might emigrate under easier circumstances, if he supplied himself with a little money from his master's till. But that evil spirit, whose understanding, I am convinced, has been much overrated, quite wasted his time on this occasion. David would certainly have liked well to have some of his master's money in his pocket, if he had been sure his master would have been the only man to suffer for it. But he was a cautious youth, and quite determined to run no risks on his own account. So he stayed out his apprenticeship, and committed no act of dishonesty that was at all likely to be discovered, reserving his plan of emigration for a future opportunity. And the circumstances under which he carried it out were in this wise. Having been at home a week or two partaking of the family beans, he had used his leisure in ascertaining a fact which was of considerable importance to him, namely, that his mother had a small sum in guineas painfully saved from her maiden perquisites, and kept in the corner of a drawer where her baby linen had reposed for the last 20 years ever since her son David had taken to his feet, with a slight promise of bow legs which had not been altogether unfulfilled. Mr. Foe, Sr., had told his son very frankly that he must not look to being set up in business by him. With 7 sons, and one of them a very healthy and well-developed idiot, who consumed a dumpling about 8 inches in diameter every day, it was pretty well if they got 100 apiece at his death. Under these circumstances, what was David to do? It was certainly hard that he should take his mother's money, but he saw no other ready means of getting any, and it was not to be expected that a young man of his merit should put up with inconveniences that could be avoided. Besides, it is not robbery to take property belonging to your mother. She doesn't prosecute you. And David was very well behaved to his mother. He comforted her by speaking highly of himself to her, and assuring her that he never fell into the vices he saw practiced by other youths of his own age, and that he was particularly fond of honesty. If his mother would have given him her 20 guineas as a reward of this noble disposition, he really would not have stolen them from her, and it would have been more agreeable to his feelings. Nevertheless, to an active mind like David's, ingenuity is not without its pleasures. It was rather an interesting occupation to become stealthily acquainted with the wards of his mother's simple key, not in the least like Chubb's patent, and to get one that would do its work equally well, and also to arrange a little drama by which he would escape suspicion and run no risk of forfeiting the prospective 100 at his father's death, which would be convenient in the improbable case of his not making a large fortune in the dies. First, he spoke freely of his intention to start shortly for Liverpool and take ship for America, a resolution which cost his good mother some pain, for, after Jacob the idiot, there was not one of her sons to whom her heart clung more than to her youngest born, David. Next, it appeared to him that Sunday afternoon when everybody was gone to church except Jacob and the cowboy, was so singularly favorable an opportunity for sons who wanted to appropriate their mother's guineas, that he half thought it must have been kindly intended by Providence for such purposes. Especially the third Sunday in Lent, because Jacob had been out on one of his occasional wanderings for the last 2 days, and David, being a timid young man, had a considerable dread and hatred of Jacob, as of a large personage who went about habitually with a pitchfork in his hand. Nothing could be easier, than for David on this Sunday afternoon to decline going to church, on the ground that he was going to tea at Mr. Lund's, whose pretty daughter Sally had been an early flame of his, and, when the churchgoers were at a safe distance, to abstract the guineas from their wooden box, and slip them into a small canvas bag. Nothing easier than to call to the cowboy that he was going, and tell him to keep an eye on the house for fear of Sunday tramps. David thought it would be easy to get to a small thicket, and bury his bag in a hole he had already made and covered up under the roots of an old hollow ash, and he had, in fact, found the hole without a moment's difficulty, had uncovered it, and was about gently to drop the bag into it, when the sound of a large body rustling towards him with something like a bellow was such a surprise to David, who, as a gentleman gifted with much contrivance, was naturally only prepared for what he expected, that instead of dropping the bag gently he let it fall so as to make it untwist, and vomit forth the shining guineas. In the same moment he looked up, and saw his dear brother Jacob close upon him, holding the pitchfork, so that the bright smooth prongs were a yard in advance of his own body, and about a foot off David's. A learned friend, to whom I once narrated this history, observed that it was David's guilt which made these prongs formidable, and that the ens nil conscious ibi strips a pitchfork of all terrors. I thought this idea so valuable, that I obtained his leave to use it on condition of suppressing his name. Nevertheless, David did not entirely lose his presence of mind, for in that case he would have sunk on the earth or started backward, whereas he kept his ground and smiled at Jacob, who nodded his head up and down, and said, "Hoich, Zavi," in a painfully equivocal manner. David's heart was beating audibly, and if he had had any lips they would have been pale, but his mental activity, instead of being paralyzed, was stimulated. While he was inwardly praying, he always prayed when he was much frightened, "Oh, save me this once, and I'll never get into danger again." He was thrusting his hand into his pocket in search of a box of yellow lozenges, which he had brought with him from Brickford among other delicacies of the same portable kind, as a means of conciliating proud beauty, and more particularly the beauty of Miss Sarah Lunn. Not one of these delicacies had he ever offered to poor Jacob, for David was not a young man to waste his jujubes and barley sugar in giving pleasure to people from whom he expected nothing. But an idiot with equivocal intentions, and a pitchfork is as well worth flattering and cajoling as if he were Louis Napoleon. So David, with a promptitude equal to the occasion, drew out his box of yellow lozenges, lifted the lid, and performed a pantomime with his mouth and fingers, which was meant to imply that he was delighted to see his dear brother Jacob, and seized the opportunity of making him a small present, which he would find particularly agreeable to the taste. Jacob, you understand, was not an intense idiot, but within a certain limited range knew how to choose the good and reject the evil. He took one lozenge, by way of test, and sucked it, as if he had been a philosopher. Then, in as great an ecstasy at its new and complex savor as Caliban at the taste of Trinculo's wine, chuckled and stroked his suddenly beneficent brother, and held out his hand for more. For, except in fits of anger, Jacob was not ferocious or needlessly predatory. David's courage half returned, and he left off praying, pouring a dozen lozenges into Jacob's palm, and trying to look very fond of him. He congratulated himself that he had formed the plan of going to see Miss Sally Lund this afternoon, and that, as a consequence, he He had brought with him these propitiatory delicacies. He was certainly a lucky fellow. Indeed, it was always likely Providence should be fonder of him than of other apprentices, and since he was to be interrupted, why, an idiot was preferable to any other sort of witness. For the first time in his life, David thought he saw the advantage of idiots. As for Jacob, he had thrust his pitchfork into the ground, and had thrown himself down beside it, in thorough abandonment to the unprecedented pleasure of having five lozenges in his mouth at once, blinking meanwhile, and making inarticulate sounds of gustative content. He had not yet given any sign of noticing the guineas, but in seating himself he had laid his broad right hand on them, and unconsciously kept it in that position, absorbed in the sensations of his palate. If he could only be kept so occupied with the lozenges as not to see the guineas before David could manage to cover them. That was David's best hope of safety, for Jacob knew his mother's guineas. It had been part of their common experience as boys to be allowed to look at these handsome coins, and rattle them in their box on high days and holidays, and among all Jacob's narrow experiences as to money, this was likely to be the most memorable. "Here, Jacob," said David, in an insinuating tone, handing the box to him, "I'll give 'em all to you. Run. Make haste. Else somebody'll come and take 'em." David, not having studied the psychology of idiots, was not aware that they are not to be wrought upon by imaginative fears. Jacob took the box with his left hand, but saw no necessity for running away. Was ever a promising young man wishing to lay the foundation of his fortune by appropriating his mother's guineas obstructed by such a daymare as this? But the moment must come when Jacob would move his right hand to draw off the lid of the tin box, and then David would sweep the guineas into the hole with the utmost address and swiftness, and immediately seat himself upon them. Ah, no. It's of no use to have foresight when you are dealing with an idiot. He is not to be calculated upon. Jacob's right age, and was given to vague clutching and throwing. It suddenly clutched the guineas, as if they had been so many pebbles, and was raised in an attitude which promised to scatter them like seed over a distant bramble, when, from some prompting, or other probably of an unwonted sensation, it paused, descended to Jacob's knee, and opened slowly under the inspection of Jacob's dull eyes. David began to pray again, but immediately desisted, another resource having occurred to him. "Mother, zinnies!" exclaimed the innocent Jacob. Then, looking at David, he said, interrogatively, "Box?" "Hush! Hush!" said David, summoning all his ingenuity in this severe strait. "E, Jacob!" He took the tin box from his brother's hand, and emptied it of the lozenges, returning half of them to Jacob, but secretly keeping the rest in his own hand. Then he held out the empty box, and said, "Here's the box, Jacob. The box for the guineas." Gently sweeping them from Jacob's palm into the box. This procedure was not objectionable to Jacob. On the contrary, the guineas clinked so pleasantly as they fell, that he wished for a repetition of the sound, and seizing the box, began to rattle it very gleefully. David, seizing the opportunity, deposited his reserve of lozenges in the ground, and hastily swept some earth over them. "Ook, Jacob," he said, at last. Jacob paused from his clinking, and looked into the hole, while David began to scratch away the earth, as if in doubtful expectation. When the lozenges were laid bare, he took them out one by one, and gave them to Jacob. "Hush," he said, in a loud whisper, "tell nobody all for Jacob hush shh. Put guineas in the hole, they'll come out like this." To make the lesson more complete, he took a guinea, and lowering it into the hole, said, "Put in so." Then, as he took the last lozenge out, he said, "Come out so, and put the lozenge into Jacob's hospitable mouth." Jacob turned his head on one side, looked first at his brother, and then at the hole, like a reflective monkey, and, finally, laid the box of guineas in the hole with much decision. David made haste to add every one of the stray coins, put on the lid, and covered it well with earth, saying in his meek coaxing tone, "Take 'em out tomorrow, Jacob. All for Jacob. Hush shh." Jacob, to whom this once indifferent brother had all at once become a sort of sweet-tasted fetish, stroked David's best coat with his adhesive fingers, and then hugged him with an accompaniment of that mingled chuckling and gurgling by which he was accustomed to express the milder passions. But if he had chosen to bite a small morsel out of his beneficent brother's cheek, David would have been obliged to bear it. And here I must pause, to point out to you the short-sightedness of human contrivance. This ingenious young man, Mr. David Faux, thought he had achieved a triumph of cunning when he had associated himself in his brother's rudimentary mind with the flavor of yellow lozenges. But he had yet to learn that it is a dreadful thing to make an idiot fond of you when you yourself are not of an affectionate disposition. Especially an idiot with a pitchfork, obviously a difficult friend to shake off by rough usage. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.